an all-encompassing interview with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. All of that and more today, July 3rd, 2023. Good morning, early birds. I'm Simone Perez, and this is the Early Bird Brief, produced by Defense News and Military Times. Last Friday, Defense News Land Warfare reporter Jen Judson spoke with General Mark Milley during a lunch at the National Press Club. Before we get started, we just had a quick announcement. Most of you know tomorrow is the 4th of July, so we will not have a daily episode tomorrow, but tune in Wednesday for a regularly scheduled episode. Now, onto the interview.
I wanted to jump in and ask you a modernization question. It's one of my favorite things. When we sat down last year, you talked about how the military really needs to look into the future and prepare. Your speech covered that quite extensively. It needs to modernize now because it must. There really is no other option. During your time as Army Chief, you recognized that imperative. You started a four-star command to tackle Army modernization. But we discussed a little bit some ideas that you had in terms of setting something up similar on the joint side, in the spirit of AFC, like AFC, Army Futures Command. So how are you thinking about this possible command or organization? And more broadly, what do you think should be the modernization priorities on the joint side?
Well, this is a long-term project. We've been doing experiments now for going on 4 years. Started when I became chief, and yes, you're right, took a page out of what we did in the Army. And so the first thing you have to have a concept of how you're going to fight. So remember the character wars, how you fight, how you organize, and with what weapons and training and so on and so forth. But the first thing you have to have is some sort of concept. So for the last 3 years, we've worked on what's called a joint warfighting concept. We just published the most recent version, JWC 3.0. That is now at a mature enough state, we think anyway, to be turned into doctrine. So we're going to publish, hopefully this month, next month, July, what's called Joint Pub 1. And doctrine for militaries, for large organizations, like large complex organizations like the military, doctrine is important because it will help clarify and inform all the various levels of the organization on how you plan to fight. And then there'll be subordinate doctrines that come out of each of the services that support the joint doctrine, et cetera. So Joint Pub 1 will come out next month, and that'll start us on a journey. It'll probably take 2 years or so for all the other documents to catch up so that we clearly establish the doctrine, how to fight. So that's important. But in addition to the doctrine, you also have to have an organization that drives it. So just the other day, Secretary Austin approved the formation of a cross-functional team led by a two-star general, which is the beginning, the embryonic beginning of a larger organization, hopefully. And that cross-functional team led by General Gaden, and I encourage you to talk to General Gaden and ask him what exactly they're doing and where they're moving out on. So that organization will help drive these concepts, but also the technologies and the describing the operational environment that we're moving into and so on. So it is in the works. It's happening. It's a long-term effort. I'm quite confident that whoever replaces me will carry that forward. It has Secretary Austin's support, and I think it's the right thing to do, and I think we also have support up on the Hill, so I think that'll move out.
Excellent. Great to hear. I'm going to jump right into the topic du jour, Ukraine and Russia. Are you concerned that Ukraine's counteroffensive is taking too long and has not shown enough progress? Are you worried that lack of progress could erode congressional support for the war?
You know, there's, and I get reports every day. I see what's on YouTube, and I'm talking to my counterpart, General Zeluzhny, frequently, and I get reports from intelligence agencies and a wide variety of other sources, right? Look, war on paper and real war are different. In real war, real people die. Real people are on those front lines. Real people are in those vehicles. Real bodies are being shredded by high explosives and so on and so forth. So when a computer tells you you're going to go this fast, maybe real war might slow it down a little bit. When we hit the beach at Normandy on 6 June 1944, we had predicted that we would be at the assault objectives in the first day, and then we predicted that we'd essentially would be in Paris. I think it was in 30 or 40 days. It took us 90 days to get to Paris. It took us forever and a day to get through the hedgerows because it was bloody hard fighting and people were dying. War is an extraordinarily violent human exercise, the likes of which very few, thankfully, personally experience. But it's unbelievable. So that it's going slower than people had predicted doesn't surprise me at all. I had said that this offensive, which is going, by the way, it is advancing steadily, deliberately, working its way through very difficult minefields, et cetera, you know, 500 meters a day, 1,000 meters a day, 2,000 meters a day, that kind of thing. Slow advance is very deliberate. That is happening. But is it happening slower than computers might have said or other people might have said? Yes. What I had said was this is going to take 6, 8, 10 weeks. It's going to be very difficult. It's going to be very long, and it's going to be very, very bloody. And no one should have any illusions about any of that. Ukraine is fighting for its life. It's an existential fight for Ukraine. And they are fighting against a very significant country of 140 million people, 9 time zones, a big army, lots of munitions, and so on and so forth. Ukraine is fighting for their life. We are giving them as much help as humanly possible. But at the end of the day, Ukrainian soldiers are assaulting through minefields and into trenches, and this is literally a fight for their life. So, yes, sure, it goes a little slow, but that is part of the nature of war.
Sure. Time is not on Ukrainian side. So how is the department thinking about sustainment over time and what's feasible coming from us?
Yeah, I wouldn't jump to that conclusion. I don't know that time is on particularly either sides right now. You just saw an example of a bolt out of the blue last weekend, right? So with the whole Prigozhin thing. Anything can happen in war. War is very dynamic. There are things that are unpredictable that happen. So I wouldn't necessarily automatically conclude that it's inevitable that time is on this side or that side or against this side or that side. That, to me, is kind of deterministic. It's a very dynamic process. There's puts and takes, and it's very, very challenging. So I wouldn't sign up to the time is necessarily working against Ukraine. Right now, there is an offensive operation going on, and I think the bravery and resilience of the Ukrainian soldiers that are fighting that offensive operation is remarkable and inspirational, actually.
Is the U.S. looking at providing cluster munitions to Ukraine to ensure Kyiv's advance isn't restricted by artillery shortfalls? Is the U.S. taking into consideration some European concerns on the use of the weapons, but could send them anyway?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not going to get out in front of decision-making by the president. That would be a decision by the president. As far as decision-making goes, we, as part of the process, we consider all kinds of options. And one of my jobs, for example, and other people's jobs is to tee up an option for the president, any president, and lay out what that option is and what the costs, risks, and benefits are, and then give them a recommendation. It's a continuous thing. It's happened many, many times over and over and over again. Specifically, you're talking about, I think, DPICM is what you're talking about. So we have been thinking about DPICM for a long time. The Ukrainians have asked for it. Other European countries have provided some of that. The Russians are using it. So, yes, of course, there's decision-making process ongoing, and it's a continuous ongoing process. To my knowledge, and I don't know of a decision yet, but sure, that's a process.
Is the U.S. potentially warming up more to sending things like ATACMs to Ukraine or F-16s?
Yeah, I don't use words like warming up or warming down. And so I would give you the same answer. ATACMs, F-16s, or anything else is in a constant review process. It's a never-ending process. And it's we on the joint staff, the services, with our Ukrainian counterparts, with our allies in Europe. Secretary Austin and I go to Europe basically once a month and do this Ukrainian contract group where we get everybody together and gather what donations we can to support Ukraine. So it's an ongoing process. It's a decision-making process. I think the president has publicly said, yeah, sure, these things are on the table. There's no decision at this point.
In your assessment, has Russian President Vladimir Putin been weakened by Prigozhin's revolt this last Friday? What are the implications for the war in Ukraine? Do you have any indications that Russian popular support for the war is eroding, or did Prigozhin's quick advance to Russia-held areas mean there's an appetite in Russia for an even more aggressive military campaign against Kyiv?
That's like 8 questions.
I know. Do you want me to take it one at a time?
Yeah, I won't be able to remember all those. So, yeah, go one at a time
all
real
right.
quick.
As Russian President
Who
Vladimir
asked that
Putin,
one? Who was the name associated with that?
I won't even look in their direction. Has Russian President Vladimir Putin been weakened by Prigozhin's revolt last Friday?
Don't know yet. I mean, frankly, it's probably too early to tell. We watch that stuff. At the end of the day, it's a matter of internal Russian politics. There's nothing we're going to do about it either way, but we certainly want to assess it. We want to know the answer to that question. So there's arguments, good arguments, on both sides. You know them all. You're writing about it every day. So there's arguments that say, yep, short-term weakness, long-term strength, long-term weakness, short-term strength. There's arguments, you know, 22 different ways from Sunday on this thing. I don't think we have evidence, conclusive evidence, either way yet. Too early to tell. Putin is a dictator. He's a vicious, violent individual who has ordered the killings, extrajudicial killings of many, many people. He's a tough guy, a hard guy. And how he responds to what happened there over last weekend with Prigozhin, I think history can tell us some indicators of what might happen, but to say that this will happen or that will happen, I don't think we know yet.
Okay. Do you have any indications that Russian popular support for the war is eroding?
Yes and no. Nothing I would say that's definitive about the entire Russian population. That's a lot of people, 140 million people. And I don't know of any nationwide Gallup polls or any of these kind of things. So, but there are some indicators, right? So when the mobilization was called up, a couple hundred thousand that were called up a while back, there were a lot of people who fled that country. A lot of military age males primarily got out of Russia. That's clearly an indicator. There is some, grumbling that there's dissension with the significant amounts of casualties. You're talking about a lot of casualties that Russia has suffered coming back to their country. And then, of course, Prigozhin, right? So Prigozhin's out there and does whatever he did, mutiny, attempt coup, whatever it was supposed to do. But he's out there making a case. He's been making the case for months that this war was predicated on a lie, that this war is not successful, this war needs to come to an end, that sort of thing, right? So interesting argument from a guy like Prigozhin. So anyway, he's out there. So those are kind of indicators. And there's many others that are in the open media. I think you can go on a wide variety of social media probably inside Russia. You guys can probably do that better than I can do it. But yeah, I think there are some indicators. I wouldn't say that they're definitive or conclusive or that it's going to result in some outcome one way or another.
How would you characterize the military abilities of the Wagner Group versus the level of skill and training of Russia's regular army?
Well, the Wagner Group are mercenaries. And there are mercenaries fight for money, not for some ideological cause, not necessarily fighting for the state sort of thing. They're fighting for profit and personal financial advancement and security. And then a good chunk of the Wagner Group are Russian prisoners. They were convicts that were released, and they were promised, if you serve successfully and survive 6 months in combat, then you'll get your freedom. And they rolled the dice and said, okay, 25 years in a Russian prison or 6 months in combat, I'll go with the combat one. So the Wagner Group's demographic is an interesting demographic. And it is not the same as the Russian military. Now, they are ruthless. Make no mistake about it. This is a ruthless, vicious group of individuals underneath some really vicious, ruthless guys. But in terms of their skill sets, I think that their demonstrated skill in the Battle of Bakhmut is where they primarily were. They suffered huge casualties. So I wouldn't say their tactical skill was particularly outstanding. What they were doing was they were sending convicts in massed frontal assaults against Ukrainian positions, and the Ukrainians were just hammering these guys and slaughtering them. And I talked to General Zaluzny one day a couple months ago, and he described it. He was down there and trooped the line sort of thing, and he described it. And he said, even though they're the enemy, he said it was just a slaughter. So I wouldn't say their tactics were particularly good. I think they're using convicts literally as human cannon fodder.
Okay. Somewhat relatedly, you know, if their tactics aren't the greatest and they're sending in convicts, you know, how essential has the Wagner Group been in the execution of Russia's war in Ukraine at this point?
I think they were very important in the Battle of Bakhmut, and they kept feeding in tens of thousands of prisoners out of these prisons. They were fighting a grinding war of attrition. So the Battle of Bakhmut lasts, I guess it's like 4 or 5 months. You have to go back and check the start dates of that thing. But it's many, many months, right? And the area that they were fighting over was basically from, you know, Washington, D.C. to Fairfax. It wasn't this huge area. So their progress, you talk about progress and measuring it in yards, the progress in the Battle of Bakhmut was tiny, and it was measured literally in yards and feet and bunker by bunker. It was very much a gruesome battle of attrition, and the Ukrainians fought it superbly in the defense, and they inflicted enough casualties on the Wagner Group that Prigozhin said enough is enough, and he withdrew, licks his wounds in some camp somewhere, whatever they did, and then they decided to do this mutiny. So I don't think that the Wagner Group, they made a contribution, yes. They did fight in Bakhmut, yes. They fixed Ukrainian forces, yes. Decisive, no, not at all.
Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has suggested a Russian defeat in Ukraine could lead to nuclear war. If a nuclear-armed Russia loses the conventional fight, what risks does that open up, and how can those risks be mitigated?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea for me at a microphone, the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., to wax and wade eloquently about nuclear war.
We tried.
That's one I'll kind of probably avoid a little bit. But let me assure you, though, that we do monitor it closely, is way closer than people may even think. So we monitor the situation with respect to the use of nuclear weapons. It's disturbing and irresponsible for public officials to go out there and rattle the nuclear saber. It's unnecessary. But we do monitor very, very closely, and I'll take a pass on that one. Jen, thank you very much.
Okay, understood, sir. In some recent remarks you made, you said that the conflict in Ukraine is a relatively small-scale conventional war, but even in that, the consumption rates of artillery and smart munitions is huge. Where are you in studying and planning to ensure the U.S. and its allies have stockpiles that are adequate for supporting a larger war or perhaps larger-scale wars going on simultaneously?
Yeah, so Secretary Austin asked us several months ago to start an analysis of our own stockpiles, U.S. stockpiles, and use the war in Ukraine as an example of consumption rates. Go back and review our war plans, our O plans, operational plans, et cetera. Go back through all the calculations and the math and all that, and then tell us if the numbers we have on the books today are about right. Are they too high? Are they too low? But let's go back and look. So we are doing that right now. We're not done with it. This is a project that is quite complex. You've got many, many types of munitions in the inventory. Each one of them is different in terms of production rates. Each one's different in terms of inventory. You have training requirements just to train and sustain the force on for ammunition. Then you got these wartime requirements, et cetera. So it's a huge accounting math drill. Then you've got to go back through every single war plan, every single O plan, and go back through all the logistics in each one and verify it. So this is a multi-month-long project. I would expect we're looking at probably another 4 to 6 months as a minimum to actually complete it. It's really a big level of effort that's going on with all the combatant commanders and their staffs, the joint staff, the services. It's a big effort.
Sure. And relatedly, we often find ourselves providing munitions and weapons to allies and partners. We provided many of our NATO partners PGM for the air campaign in Libya, Desert Shield Storm, saw much of the same. Now the effort with Ukraine. Should the U.S. begin to include these requirements in our calculations for war reserve stocks? Should we maintain an extra revolving account of munitions that we can provide to allies and partners for immediate response that can be paid back later potentially?
We do a little bit. We did a little bit before include them in the accounts. But now, given the experience of Ukraine, we should probably increase our accounting for foreign military sales and support to other countries and what munitions they may need. We've done that in the past, but not to the degree that we're doing right now, and we probably need to adjust based on that, sure.
Before moving on to China, what constitutes victory in Ukraine, in your view?
Well, the President of the United States, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, all of the political heads of NATO, or most of them anyway, that I know of, they've all said the same thing. Ukraine became a free, independent, sovereign country in 1991. They've been free and independent since then. So the end state, what constitutes victory, is a free, independent, sovereign Ukraine with its territory intact. And when that state is achieved, then you know with certainty the rules-based international order has been upheld. Because the rule one is you're not allowed to, you know, overrun and conquer countries in wars of aggression without some logical reason for defense. Ukraine was never, ever going to attack Russia. Russia conducted an unprovoked war of aggression against Ukraine. So at the end of the day, if you believe the rules-based order matters, if you believe the end of World War II matters, if you believe the deterrence and prevention of a great power war, if you believe that framework is one of many things that contributes to maintaining 8 consecutive decades of peace, then that rules-based order matters. And in order to make sure that it's visible to the world, that it matters, it's important, and it succeeded, then Ukraine must end up free, independent, sovereign with its territory intact.
Okay. So moving on to the other major pacing threat, China. China's president has said it plans to be superior to U.S. military by 2027. The U.S. Army has set a goal of modernizing by the 2030 timeframe, other services as well. Do you believe the Chinese military could hit that mark to be superior by 2027? Is the U.S. running out of time to modernize?
I do think that we have to go quickly. Running out of time, I think, is relative, but I think the United States military needs to accelerate our modernization. And it's not so much just the actual modernization, but it's the acceptance of the idea that future war, the fundamental character of war, is actually changing in really significant, radical ways that I tried to outline briefly in those remarks. And if we, the military, don't adapt ourselves, our doctrine, our tactics, our techniques, our leader development, our training and talent management, but also the weapon systems, if we don't do that, then we won't have a military that's capable of operating in that future operating environment. That operating environment is coming, whether people like it or not. It's coming. So you have to prepare for that, and that's going to require significant change. So when I said, you know, for example, you have to be small and in constant motion in order to survive. You know, if you're dead, you're not going to be any contribution to fighting the war. So you have to survive. First principle of any unit in a combat situation, you got to be able to survive. So you're going to have to operate like that. Now, we don't necessarily operate like that right now in a constant state of motion. And there's so many implications to that. And what does small mean? What does small mean in a highly dense urban area? What's it mean in the ocean? What's it mean in the sky? So these things have all got to get figured out. We've got to make those adjustments, and we have to make them faster, probably, than we are. With respect to what you said about what President Xi said, I'll leave those statements, on their own. He has stated publicly that he has challenged the People's Liberation Army to develop the military capability to unify Taiwan with China by 2027. He didn't say, I've decided to attack and invade. He said, you generals, you develop the capability to do that. We'll make the decision later, but he didn't say he would do that. So there's a very subtle distinction there. The decision-making process would still have to occur, and that's what I'm getting at with the idea of deterrence. You want to make sure that every single day, President Xi wakes up and says, today is not that day, and that decision never comes, and that's the whole essence of deterrence. So the faster we move out, the faster we can retain military superiority, then I believe the theory of the case is that we are more likely than not to deter war from happening. And if war does happen, we'll prevail over any opponent.
Okay, great. On aid to Ukraine / Taiwan, some lawmakers complain the extensive U.S. military aid to Ukraine is hurting U.S. efforts to supply Taiwan with the military systems that the military needs. What's your take on that? Are the two nations competing for the same systems and same weapons and systems?
Yes and no, I suppose. No, because they both require, in some cases, different weapons. Yes, in the sense that so there are some weapons that they both need and want, and you only have X amount, so you have to manage that and balance it and so on. So, and that work is being done. There's a little bit of a yes and a no in there. It's not as clean cut as it's automatic competition and zero sum game. It's not like that. And there are other allies and partners out there. It's not just the United States. There's many allies and partners out there that are willing to help Ukraine and others that are willing to help Taiwan.
All right. I'm going to shift over to ask a little bit about misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, and that's always played a role in military actions. The Russians and Chinese appear to have raised it to an art form, and artificial intelligence promises to make it even harder to discern truth from lies. Over your career, what changes have you noticed and confronted in the information wars? How is the U.S. military training for this threat, and how do you think the U.S. military should prepare for a growing threat in the future?
Well, first of all, I think it's real. I think that that is part of the changing fundamental character of war is the operational environment and the idea of misinformation and disinformation and the power of artificial intelligence to either mimic or create false information out there that's very, very believable. That's all very real. We see that now almost every day. You've been seeing it for years, actually. By various countries that are putting information out through various information mechanisms, that is utterly false. Now, the use of propaganda, misinformation, disinformation is as old as warfare. But what is different today is the size, scale, and speed and believability of the information. So I would argue that pamphleteering back in a long time ago, that was a form, I suppose, of propaganda. There was leaflet drops and all kinds of stuff in the past, right? Very, very common. But today, with the use of the technologies that are available, communication technologies that are available today, and the reach that they have, it's having a huge impact on the conduct of war. So that's on the information piece. There's also electronic warfare and the ability to collect signals intelligence, the jam and spoof and all of those sorts of things in the electronic spectrum. That's also advanced to phenomenal degrees. All of it puts at risk your ability to command and control. Now, luckily for us, the United States military, we've been trained for a long, long time on a doctrine referred to in the U.S. military as mission command, intent-based tactics. We delegate decision authority to very, very low levels with issuing out essentially the purpose of the operation to the subordinate. You describe the end state to be achieved. You give the subordinate constraints and restraints. You let them develop the plan. You look at the plan. You say, okay, go. And then during the execution of the plan, if the subordinate doesn't have communications with you, they operate off that intent, and they're always trying to achieve the purpose. So, for example, if you're told to attack Hill 101 for the purpose in order to destroy the enemy, and you go up and you conduct your reconnaissance and you see Hill 101, you see Hill 102, and the enemy's on Hill 102, but you were told to attack Hill 101, what do you do? Well, in order to achieve the purpose, destroy the enemy, you attack Hill 102. So you disobey the specific instruction of attack Hill 101, and you obey and achieve the purpose. That gives you wide flexibility. That's a very simplistic sort of example of that, but that gives subordinate commanders wide latitude to make decisions within the spirit and intent of the commander in order to achieve the stated purpose. Our military operates like that, and it's part and parcel of our society. We are not a top-down society. We are a free society, and our soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines reflect that. So they naturally come to mission command anyway. So it's a technique that we've developed for a long, long time, and we're all practiced and trained in it. So that's one thing. The second thing is you have to learn some of the older versions of tactics, and this requires training. We have to learn how to operate or fight through interference on your networks. You have to now train in how to identify misinformation that might be happening on your networks. And you have to be able to do things in perhaps a GPS environment that's denied, with precision navigation and timing reliant upon a lot of electronic systems that maybe come from satellites, et cetera. You might have to go back to maps and compasses at times, depending on where you are and who you are. So all that requires training and education, and that's what we're doing, and we do that at our training centers, and we're trying to acclimatize the force to that type of operating environment.
It appears the Pentagon is a lone holdout in consensus over evidence sharing with the International Criminal Court on war crimes committed by Russia in Ukraine. Can you say why are you in favor of sharing evidence of Russian war crimes to the ICC?
I would just say war crimes have been committed by Russia. The indiscriminate shelling of civilian populations by policy, not by accident, by policy is a war crime by international law. The slaughter of citizens in some of the towns and cities of Ukraine by Russian troops is a war crime. So I fully support the ICC in pursuit of those, and we'll see which way it goes.
Okay. Lots of people in the audience, myself included, want to know what your plans are for your retirement. And one of the questions is, would you be open to considering a run for public office after you retire from U.S. military?
Well, first of all, in all honesty, absolutely not to the second question. Zero. I'm a soldier. I can make contributions to my country after I retire in many, many different ways. Public office is not one of them for me. I respect people who do that, but it's not for me. On the first one, I don't know. I literally don't know. This is a 24/7 job. I've got a job to do, which is to protect and defend the Constitution, protect the American people. And it is a very, very challenging environment every single day, day in and day out, 24/7, weekends included, and the whole nine yards. No matter where I go, I've got communication teams with me and always wired in. So I literally have not had time to kind of figure all that out. That'll come from 1 October on. So I retire at midnight by law on the 30th of September. So beginning 1 October, my wife and I will turn the chapter, and then we'll figure it out. But right now, we don't even know where we're going to live. So I told her we can go to Dick's and get a tent, and I'm good with that. Okay. Lived in a tent before, so.
All right.
But I don't know. I don't know.
All right. Thank you so much. Before we conclude today's discussion, let me take a moment to thank headliners, co-team leaders Donna Linewin-Legere and Lori Russo, as well as club membership events and program coordinators Cecily Scott-Martin and club's new executive director, Didier Saoji. It's also my honor to present to you, General, the much-coveted National Press Club mug.
Very good.
Now, I understand you now have a pair. You did speak here before, so you can now share coffee and tea with your wife in your retirement and think about
I just want
the value
it's
of freedom
under $20.
Of the press. Yeah, it is. Absolutely under $20.
It's the only way I can accept it.
On the
okay,
record.
Hey, thanks very much.
And
are we done? No?
Almost.
Almost.
Let me also remind our audience of an upcoming Headliners event. Monday, July 17th, SEC Chair Gary Gensler will join us for a Headliners luncheon. You can get your tickets at press.org. And now for the very last question.
This is always the last question.
This is a job with huge responsibilities that you've had. But is there anything you will miss?
Sure. I'll miss a lot
Elaborate.
Of it. I mean, look, I'm in my 44th year of service in uniform. And you don't do that, for the money, that's for damn sure. So you're doing it for a sense of purpose. You're doing it out of a sense of being part of an organization that is larger than yourself. And I am constantly inspired and really enjoy soldiers and the various officers I interact with all the time. And I'll get less of that, obviously, in retirement. So the camaraderie, sense of purpose, that may or may not be on the other side. I'm going to try to make it on the other side so that it is still there. I don't want to ever lose that because that has been my life's work. That'll continue to be my life's work. And as long as I have a breath to draw, I'll defend the Constitution.
All right. Well, thank you, sir, so much for taking the time today. We wish you best of luck in your retirement.
That's it for us this morning. To get more top stories and breaking news, go to defensenews.com/EBB to subscribe to the Early Bird Brief newsletter. Please give us a like, rating, and a comment wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to follow us on social media @defense_news and @militarytimes. The Early Bird Brief is hosted and produced by me, Simone Z. Perez. Today's episode features an interview by our very own Judge Judson. Our editor-in-chief is Mike Groos. Have a great day.